From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski, and we appreciate you tuning into the program this month on your Indiana Public Broadcasting station. If ever you have a question you'd like to get on the program, please email that to news@wbaa.org. Or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we always talk a little bit about this in the summer. I think people think of it as the beginning of downtime, but it's not necessarily that way in academia. What are you focused on as your quote-unquote summer kicks off?
Well, right now I'm a little intimidated. I'm sitting here with a star of television.
Nah.
And congratulations on your own recent venture on national television.
Thank you.
I trust by this time the audience is aware that you were a Jeopardy contestant.
And I appreciate you mentioning that. Thank you very much.
It was yourself well.
I didn't fall on my face at the very least, so which is always the goal with this show as well.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll try to hold up my end. No, you're right. Summer is different, of course, but busy in its own way. I don't have to tell you or any nearby resident how busy we are from a construction standpoint, trying to move those a variety of projects along while they create at least less disruption than they would during the school year, and preparing for a new class, the biggest one in a long time. We will probably be at total student population, be at record or near record levels, combination of somewhat larger classes and better success at retaining students. A lot to plan for. We'll be a little pinched for space, residential space, but that's the problem you want.
And that's a problem that's happened the last couple of years as well. So are you dealing with that any differently now that you're in year about three of having to deal with, especially at the beginning of the fall semester? For people who don't know, you've had people who have had to kind of move into rooms in the Union Hotel or move into kind of makeshift rooms until there's some attrition or some rooms that open up, things like that.
Yeah, I'll have an update meeting actually this afternoon, and so I'll know a little more than I know right now. But from the written reports I've been getting, our folks seem to have it under control now. It's easy when you don't have to be the one to do it, and I know a lot of effort has gone into it. One thing, of course, is that there's been a proliferation of new housing options approved recently. Some of them are moving right along, and there's going to be a lot more housing on or very near the campus within the next year or two than there's probably ever been. And so I think we feel like we have this under control.
Well, even though it's, the summer, where there's a lot of things on the docket to try and get through in this program, so we'll get through as many as we can here. We've talked a lot on this program about you trying to make sure that Purdue is efficient with its money and trim budgets in some places. And I had an interesting conversation with a couple of different people I've gotten to know in budgetary positions around the university. And I wanted to see if something I had heard was true, which is that you had put in something of an informal rule that makes it a little bit harder to create new jobs, not to fill ones that already exist, but to create new ones. Is that accurate?
I guess it is. I mean, we don't have a formal system for it. It's very important that we have some, that somebody asked the question before we create a job, which may be there for a very long time. And so we do challenge those. And in fact, we need to do better than we have at challenging the automatic replacement of jobs that come open, too. We've got a lot of business processes, a lot going on right now to try to modernize what are some very antique business processes we still have. We have people writing things up on paper, moving the paper across campus. Sometimes it's re-entered a second time, let's say, in another computer. Things that you would think we'd left behind a long time ago. So there are some groups working on that. And as you make those improvements, you want to make sure that you capture the efficiencies that should come from them.
And one of the other things I've heard from people who say that this rule exists, informal as it is that if a department does want to go down that path and try to create a new job, that it might actually open them up to additional budgetary scrutiny, where the thought process being something on the order of, all right, if your Department X is doing well enough that you think you can create this new position, then maybe we should look at the money that you're getting from the university and determine whether you've got the right subsidy level from the campus. Is that something that happens?
I guess I know what you're getting at. I mean, there are a couple things here. One of them is that right now our total staffing at Purdue is as high as it's ever been, possibly the highest it's ever been. The question is, where did it grow? And the answer is faculty. We have the biggest faculty we've ever had. We have the most tenure track faculty we've ever had, and one of the highest percentages of tenure track to total of any school in our category. So we've had growth there, and in the professional staff that support them, the all other has barely moved in the last several years. And so that's the kind of growth we want. We want growth in the positions that directly relate to the teaching of students. And we're fine with that. And, of course, with a larger student body, you would expect to have more faculty and those who work directly on learning at Purdue.
Does that mean it's easier to create a faculty line item, which might be a higher salary line item than a staff or a support positions elsewhere in the university? Does that make it easier for the academic units to create the jobs than the support units?
Well, that's what we're here for. And so, you want to make sure you have the student demand. We have some malapportionment of that still. We have demand for certain disciplines, departments, colleges goes up and down over the course of time. And so we have some places where we have a high ratio of faculty to students, other places where we really are stretched, where we've got a lot of students per faculty member. And so another challenge that we have is making sure we have some flexibility to grow where we need to and not grow where it's unnecessary.
Does that equate at all to a penalty for success for those non-teaching units of the university that may be doing well, that may be keeping their bottom line well enough in order, that if they come to you, whoever they need to go to, and say, we'd like to create another position, and then they sort of get audited by the university, is that any kind of penalty for their doing well up to that point?
Better not be. That's our intention is always to praise and to reward success. As you may recall, for each of the last 3 years, when we've made more money available for raises, we have conditioned the last 0.5% for any given unit on participation in inefficiency moves that are good for the whole institution. And so we've tried to incentivize everybody to find ways to be more efficient with headcount, with space, with dollars generally. And so that's you really want to reward success, not ever the opposite.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. You can always email questions for this program to news@wbaa.org. You gave a speech recently in Northwest Indiana where you took them to task a little bit for, maybe just to put it bluntly, some of the corruption that the region has been historically known for. I wondered if you worry that the atmosphere up there is, for instance, hurting Purdue Northwest, which you just put together from a couple of campuses and obviously benefits from or is detracted by the atmosphere, I guess, in the region. What was your aim in taking that part of your speech?
Oh, I've been invited by this particular civic group several times, and I finally was able to go. It was actually sponsored by the Northwest Times, the number one newspaper up there, and I didn't say anything that I hadn't said before. In my last job, I made 77 trips to Lake County alone, plus others to Porter County and LaPorte and Stark and counties in the so-called region. Why? First of all, it is the second biggest population center in our state. But more important, it's sort of cut off from the rest of Indiana. All their news basically comes from Chicago. They know a lot more about events in Illinois than they do in the state that they live in and pay taxes to. And so I tried my level best to get through with shoe leather. And I found out how hard it is, by the way. You can go and go and go, and only the people in the room ever know you were there. So, but when I was there, I always made this point. I said that over and over that Indiana will not be the state it ought to be until every part of Indiana succeeds, especially this very large and important corner. And I've told them many times that especially now with Illinois in the bad shape it's in, there are stories on the TV and radio up there all the time now about people and businesses leaving Illinois and coming in many cases to Indiana. And my point has always been that that corner could really blossom, but it has its own issues to clean up. In some respects, it looks a little too much like Illinois. There's a lot of there's a tradition, unfortunately, there has been, of what's in it for me government, and sometimes outright corruption. And
so in your speech, you said you wanted cities to work together more and not, as you put it, and I'm quoting now, everyone chiseling and protecting their own turf. Do you think that's getting in the way of, for instance, your higher education interest up there?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to hurt PNW, although it may limit its potential a little bit. You know, we're working with PNW now on a tuition policy that would be very would be more welcoming to students from Illinois who might decide in greater numbers than they already do to come across to Purdue Northwest. No, I don't think it's a – and I didn't say that it's a particular problem for our institution up there. It's just that as somebody who really wants them to succeed, I think they do get in each other in their own way from time to time. So the point you made is another really important one. They are very balkanized up there. They have lots of little communities and the townships and way too many units of government. And it leads to higher taxes, and it leads to things moving more slowly. It makes it harder to do business. And one day, I hope they will look a little less like their Chicagoland neighbors and more like the rest of Indiana. And if that ever happens, there'll be a land rush, I believe, of people and businesses across the line, where right now it's just a steady flow.
You also gave a speech recently to the or gave a talk recently with the Education Writers Association at one of their conferences, and you spoke against what you called the culture of committees at universities. And I think we can all agree that there are too many committees in the world writ large. But I wanted to ask you, isn't it possible, especially on a university campus where you've got so many smart, learned people, that there is, in fact, significant value to that culture of committees, because you have the uncommon ability to bring together so many people who are so, so expert in a particular topic or so good at measuring out how to solve problems?
Well, of course there is. But I'm hardly the first person to observe that maybe we take it to great a degree, and that there's a slowness sometimes about the process where you don't get the value you could, or you pay a price. And that was the nature of the question that came from the audience, and everybody there nodded. They knew what I was talking about. And, you know, it's save us from headline writers, though. I know at least one account of that panel said that I blasted the culture of committees, and we'll go look at the tape. I'm not in the business of blasting anybody or anything. I was poking a little fun at how slow we can be, how slow higher ed in general can be. And, you know, this is not the kind of world where you can take forever to innovate or to respond to a new challenge.
One of the other things you said was, and again, quoting now, places that are supposed to be havens of free inquiry too often are places where conformity of thought is enforced. We've talked a lot about free speech on this campus and things like that. Do you think there is some of that enforcement of conformity of thought still at Purdue?
Well, it's not enforced by policy. We've been recognized, and I think this is something we should all celebrate. We've been recognized as protecting free inquiry in the way that universities once did. I know from hearing from a number of people that there's a little bit of self-censorship that goes on, that folks are afraid to say sometimes what they think because they believe they'll be harshly criticized. But that's a different thing than having institutional policies that intimidate people or penalize them for simply speaking up.
What I'm particularly interested in with this conversation is kind of the subtext of it, because, of course, it comes on the heels of your conversations with the Faculty Senate about the Kaplan deal, and you had some differences of opinion, which we talked about on last month's program. And it seems to me that this is potentially an interesting turning point in the discussion between what I think have for a long time been thought of as liberal-thinking universities, and there have been plenty of conservative writers who have said, look, we need a moderation of what has historically been the liberal higher ed academic atmosphere. And I couldn't help but thinking after reading your comments whether the Kaplan deal is a sort of tipping point in this, because you've said on this program and plenty of other places you'd like the culture of universities, just like you thought for the state of Indiana, to be more businesslike, operate a little more like businesses in some cases. And there are a lot of people who would say that that's a more conservative ideal than the way universities have operated in the past. So do you think that the Kaplan deal could go that way as being a larger subtext for this conversation of conservative ways of looking at a university versus the traditional, I guess, liberal definition of a university?
No. You know, it's interesting that the very same comment that you just quoted from, you quoted the first third of it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I quoted it in part.
I don't remember how the question came, but I said, you know, there are a lot of ironies around higher ed, so I mentioned that one. But the one I was really headed for was the second or third clause of the answer, where I said something to the effect that the same universities that are at their best seedbeds of innovation, as we are here at Purdue, you know, 12th in the world in patents in the most recent year, 27 new companies last year, all that business, are sometimes these same places which are giving the world a lot of innovation are very slow to innovate themselves. Now, I see the Kaplan move in that context, that I hope that this will, over the course of time, reflect well on Purdue as a place that saw a mission and a new way to reach it. The millions of people who started college and didn't finish, the millions of working adults who will only have a really successful life if they add some knowledge and some credential to what they have now, and that we found a novel way to serve that population. So, in that respect, I hope it will represent a. A departure from the status quo in higher ed, but it has nothing to do, at least in my judgment, has nothing to do with philosophy.
Well, I don't mean this next question to sound cynical, though it may come off that way. There is an interesting business angle, of course, to the Kaplan deal as well, that I think a lot of other universities are looking at and watching to see what happens with Purdue. And I've, you know, known you for a long time and watched you from the time you were governor to now. And it strikes me that knowing business like you do, having been in the business world before coming to academia and before coming to being in public office, you're very good at looking several steps down the road. It's kind of one of the things you're known for, is playing the long game really well. And I get the sense, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, that you wouldn't have done the Kaplan deal solely because that it's going to be good for education in the state, but you wouldn't have done it if you thought there was huge risk to Purdue. My thinking is that you thought somewhere down the line, this is good for reputation, or this is good for the university's bottom line, something that really benefits the organization as a whole in other ways than just educating more people. Is that fair?
Yeah, of course we want it, and we do believe it has an excellent chance to be a very good thing for Purdue. I hope in more than a defensive way. You've heard me say I didn't want in my rocking chair days whoever has my current job saying, why were those people asleep at the switch? You know, how dumb did you have to be not to see the steady growth of online education and new technologies? And how could they leave us bereft? So, yes, in that sense, I do believe it's in Purdue's institutional interest to have these capabilities, which I do think do match up with our land-grant mission very well. And, yes, if it's successful in the way that it very well could be, it will create a revenue stream that can support whatever Purdue wants to do in that future time. And believe me, you can say that's business, but every university and college of every kind is thinking the same thing right now. They're always thinking about where money will come from. In the past, the answer was easy. Just jack up tuition. And they did, year after year after year. But that's not the only way to meet rising costs and fund new things and build new buildings.
I guess this is what I'm getting at is, you know, you've taken a decidedly different approach than a lot of universities have taken in terms of how money is collected and spent. And it, I think it does fit into this larger conversation of are universities liberal institutions, more conservative institutions? And of course, there's huge definition for what's liberal, what's conservative. But it strikes me that the Kaplan deal is a point along that path of how we view a university atmosphere.
I think the only fair description is there's a traditional approach, and then there are approaches that at least attempt to be innovative and more experimental, and that's where this one fits.
I wanted to ask you about something else you wrote recently. You and your Aspen Institute co-chair George Miller penned an article for Time magazine, and it was interesting. You were talking about the responsibility of community colleges in higher education, and you pointed out actually something that a lot of law, or you pointed kind of vaguely to something a lot of lawmakers here in Indiana have said about Ivy Tech, which is, look, a lot of community colleges need to do better. They need to be innovative. They need to have different ways of operating. And I wanted to know, you didn't mention Ivy Tech, of course, directly in that article. Were you thinking of them in some part or sending us kind of on the sly message to them?
I think about them a lot. And yes, we need them to do better and get stronger. I don't – that article that I penned with Congressman Miller, longtime, by the way, very liberal member of Congress, fine person and a leader in education. I knew him from my federal service before. You know, so here's an example where folks who may disagree on other things, he and I see the urgency of better results across the whole community college system very much the same. And please note that community colleges are maybe our first line or our front line in trying to reach those working adults that we've been talking about in the Kaplan context. We'll never really make a dent in the 36 million target audience there unless community colleges are playing a very big role. And, you know, Kaplan has twice the graduation rate of Ivy Tech. And you know, we want to see in the next, the so-called new U, we wanted to get higher still. But now, I'm not blaming anybody. It just shows, and I learned in that in the years of heading up that jury with Congressman Miller for the Aspen Institute, there's some fabulous community colleges, but they are incredibly different. They're as different as the geography of this country and the demography of this country, and the challenges are diverse, but also almost always large. And it's very hard to do what we ask them to do. I have a lot of respect for those who are slugging it out.
Do you think there's a lot of crossover between the high school seniors who are considering Purdue and the ones who would consider Ivy Tech? Do you think that there's a lot? I mean, clearly there are a lot of people who go to 2 years at Ivy Tech somewhere in Indiana and transfer to Purdue or IU. That happens a lot. But when they're coming right out of college, do you get the sense that you're competing for the same students right out of the gate?
To a small extent, from anything I can tell. And again, the quality, the number, you know, our Admissions, as you recall, I'm sorry, our applications have just skyrocketed over the last few years. And so the competition just in Indiana, let alone the rest of the country and the world, to get into Purdue is getting tougher and tougher. That probably means that there are somewhat fewer students who are really viable candidates for here that are also looking at Ivy Tech. But
so that being the case, I want to ask this next question. Could it be seen that, you know, since you are the head of a major Research One university and you're saying, look, you community colleges out there, you guys need to be doing better. If there is, on the off chance, a student, a senior who's looking at you versus looking at Ivy Tech, couldn't they read this article and go, hey, maybe I want to go to the institution headed by that guy instead of the community college that even lawmakers have said, look, your 6-year graduation rate for Ivy Tech is abysmal.
If they can succeed at Purdue, I want them to come to Purdue. That's why we've been trying to make room for more students, and we'll have a record number, or at least in a long, long time, of Hoosier students in the incoming freshman class. But that leaves a lot of other folks who need a different option, and we want Ivy Tech to be as successful as it can be. I don't think near enough in Indiana students go the community college to the two, sort of 2+2 route. You're quite right. That's always been the a principal ambition for that system, but in our state, it hasn't worked nearly as often as it should or as it does in other places.
Well, it strikes me too that this article, if you're gently prodding at former Lieutenant Governor Elsperman and her organization at Ivy Tech, and I know you're not prodding at her specifically because I know that you two have a good relationship, but that might work out long run well for Purdue. If you improve the community college system, understanding that there are lots of 2-year transfers into Purdue from Ivy Tech, then if you gently give them a little kick in the pants and say, it'd be really good if you guys were a little better, well, that makes it a little better for you guys too, for Purdue.
Sure. The whole point of the Aspen Institute, the prize that I was asked to help to co-chair these last few years, is to identify the very, very best in the community college world and then hold them up so that others can imitate them, and try to help everybody get better. And this is an urgent national need, to say nothing of our situation here in Indiana. It's a need everywhere. And I'm going to take you back to the fact that, yes, while there are a lot of students who enter it right out of high school and get an associate degree and then maybe try to step up, the big percentage of the students there are those same folks who we're talking about with regard to Purdue's new layer, those working adults for whom a full-time residential experience for the time has passed for them.
All right. Well, Mr. President, as always happens, there's more questions on the sheet, but not enough time to get to them this month. So how about we do it next month?
Well, you know, we can do it Jeopardy style if you want.
That could be fun.
You give the answers and I'll give the questions.
That could be interesting. I think we're breaking new ground on this program all the time. Thanks very much, as always. This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember, anytime you'd like to send a question for this program, the email address to do that is news@wbaa.org. And you can always find these shows archived at our website, wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Major support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at Gaylor.com.